Aaron Day, entrepreneur, CEO of Daylight Freedom and Brownstone Institute Fellow. Welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So Aaron, I wanted to start today by talking with you about stablecoins. You know, there's a lot that we have to cover today, but I think a good kind of place to dive into all of this stuff is to really kind of start by talking about and evaluating the risks and realities of the framework that the Genius and Stable Acts bring to the U.S. financial system. You know, we heard about this executive order that Trump made, ostensibly banning CBDCs, but how do these bills essentially set the groundwork for more financial surveillance and control?
Yeah, so this is problematic. I actually ran for president in 2024 specifically to raise awareness around the CBDC issue. I wrote this book called The Final Countdown, and I'm based here in New Hampshire. And so I would talk to the other presidential candidates. I wasn't running to win. I was running to raise awareness. And I talked to Vivek Ramaswamy about it. He read my book. And actually, I pushed him. I kind of hounded him to push Trump on the CBDC issue. And so then when Trump came out against CBDCs, people were like, you must be really relieved that we dodged the bullet, you know. And unfortunately, in a way, the reverse has happened with this Genius Act. And so the idea here is, so with a central bank digital currency, the problem with the central bank digital currency isn't the central bank, believe it or not. Not that I would ever defend the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is an unnecessary third party. But it turns out when I was writing my book and studying how this actually works, most of our money today is already digital. Mm-hmm. So for instance, the Federal Reserve uses an Oracle database. That when the government writes their checks on that account, it is by definition a central bank digital currency. Banks also use databases. This is how all of this works. And so it turns out we have a lot of heavy surveillance on our digital money today. I identified in an article that I did for Brownstone 13 different federal programs that are used to track our digital money today, whether it's NSA bulk data collection or the Bank Secrecy Act. So anytime you go to set up a bank account or even a crypto account and you have to give all of this information and now biometric information, that's started in 1970 with the Bank Secrecy Act. And then they added more and more and more surveillance with the Patriot Act and everything else. So it turns out that all of this surveillance that we already have doesn't come from the Federal Reserve. Mm-hmm. It comes primarily from Congress. So what they did with the Genius Act is they took stable coins, and a stable coin, very simply, is a digital token that represents fiat currency, represents a dollar. So one token equals $1. There's some nuance to this, but in any event, it is a digital form of fiat currency. And stablecoins have become very popular. The two biggest companies are Tether and USDC. Mm-hmm. And last year, people did about $27 trillion worth of transactions globally using stablecoins. So they've become very popular. Now, frankly, they're more about $27 trillion.
Wow.
It's actually more transaction volume than Visa. A lot of it is overseas. There are a lot of people in other countries where it's really hard to do cross-border transactions. And then if you're in countries that have currencies that are devaluing even faster than the dollar, then the dollar is still the global reserve currency. So for a lot of reasons, stablecoins have become popular. Mm-hmm. So what they've done is they've taken these popular private solutions and now put them under the control of Congress, which is the entity that does all of the financial surveillance, and the Federal Reserve. So in essence, I actually refer to it as a backdoor CBDC, because if they pushed a CBDC, there would actually be resistance to it. But now they've managed to find a way, using, you know, propaganda and everything else, to say, well, no, this isn't a CBDC. We're against CBDCs. We don't want to become like China. This is about innovation in crypto. And in reality, what they've done is they've taken a private solution and added CBDC-like surveillance and tracking to it. Mm-hmm. So it's a big problem, because if you launched a CBDC, you wouldn't get $27 trillion worth of financial transactions in probably 10 years. You'd have all kinds of implementation issues. You would have resistance to it. Now, based on the trajectory of stablecoin use, by 2030, there's expected to be something like $120 trillion a year in transactions using stablecoins, which is more than Visa, MasterCard, and direct deposit combined. So in essence, we've just digitized and put under central control the use of digital dollars as a payment mechanism.
Mm-hmm. So how does this tie into the U.S. being able to continue to, you know, fund itself and basically service its debt? You know, this is being looked at as the panacea for the U.S., you know, treasury demand. How does that help them in that respect?
Yeah, so we have a problem, right? So we have $38 going on $39 trillion worth of debt. Our debt, the United States debt, was downgraded at the beginning of the year. And countries like China and Japan, who have been buying our treasuries, are not in a mood to continue to do that or even have the capacity to do it like they used to. So one of the reasons that the administration, and particularly Treasury Secretary Bessent, got so excited about the Genius Act is that part of the Genius Act is forcing stablecoin issuers to back their stablecoins by U.S. treasuries. So let me explain what this means. So Tether and USDC, who I described earlier, are the popular stablecoins. They were not required to back those stablecoins by dollars or treasuries. They could have backed those as long as they had enough, you know, where you knew that there was at least a dollar's worth of something backing a dollar worth of a stablecoin, then everything was fine. So Tether, it turns out, is one of the largest holders of gold, maybe, although I'm not going to defend their practices. They haven't actually been able to pass an audit. And so there are some actual real material concerns about this. But they have Bitcoin, they have gold, they have silver, they have land, they have other commodities backing this. Well, now they're being forced under the Genius Act to not use Bitcoin or gold to back their popular stablecoin. They're now forced to buy U.S. treasuries. And so our Treasury Secretary has said that he believes we'll be able to sell at least $2 trillion worth of treasuries because of this forced backing of stablecoins. And so, I mean, I'm not a big fan of government debt and what the government does with that debt. And this Genius Act has done two things. It's essentially created a backdoor CBDC, and it's being used to add more debt and fund more, you know, I would argue, tyranny, U.S. tyranny around the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you put it perfectly that there is supposed to be a dollar backing each of those stable coins, right, or each of those tokens, but we don't necessarily know how those tokens are being backed. And it's interesting that the S&P recently downgraded Tether as well because of their Bitcoin holdings, right?
Yeah. Now, of course, the Federal Reserve also hasn't been audited. So we're in a situation where we have fiat currency, which is printed out of thin air, backed by nothing and not audited. And now we have a digital surveillance token on top of that that's representing that may not be backed by anything. So this is not a stable situation, nor is this sound money. I mean, at the end of the day, people use money so that they can buy and sell goods and services. This is the purpose of money as a medium of exchange. And instead, we've got a layer of Ponzi scheme on top of Ponzi scheme, and now we're adding digital surveillance on mm-hmm. top of that.
Yeah, that layer of complexity seems like it doesn't add any reliability, but it just adds more opacity and maybe a layer of confusion to be able to, you know, continue propagating this current system, right?
Yeah, I mean, we're at the end stage of this. In my book, I wrote a lot about the history of fiat currencies. And it turns out these government-issued currencies have a 100% failure rate. Mm-hmm. The average fiat currency only lasts about 27 years. And even when you think about something like the U.S. dollar, which is now a global reserve currency, when you look at the previous five global reserve currencies, I believe even the global reserve currencies collapsed after like 85 years or something like that, or 84 years. So the U.S., by every metric, is a declining fiat currency. There are seven main reasons why fiat currencies fail, and actually the U.S. is blinking bright red on all seven. And usually you don't need all seven to collapse, but we're hitting our target.
So, Aaron, how does this, you know, we're talking about basically the tokenization of everything. We're talking about now that I believe it was BlackRock is building a particular type of blockchain product that tokenizes gold and diamonds and things like that. Does this really defeat the purpose of gold and hard assets being held outside the system?
Well, I've been a big fan of tokenization for a long time, since 2018, because once you start to understand how most economies work, everything is traded digitally. It's not just money itself, but I mean, you look at stocks. Stocks are all traded digitally, and they use centralized databases. And centralized databases, as we know, are subject to central control. The transactions can be reversed, they can be hacked. So tokenization itself isn't necessarily a bad idea. It can actually be a better way for people to trade assets because it's more secure, and then depending on how you do it, there's more integrity to the process. Unfortunately, that's not what we're getting in the instance of what BlackRock and others are doing. What we're getting is we're basically tokenizing not just money, but everything that you own, your stocks, your retirement plan, oil, everything is going to be tokenized in a way that has the same surveillance as CBDCs. So now it can be tracked, now it can be programmed, now it can be censored. So now you have to worry about, well, if you say something wrong or you do something that the government doesn't like, you have to worry more than just about having your money cut off. You could actually have everything that you own cut off, including your house, your car, and everything else, and be prohibited from trading it. And so, unfortunately, what BlackRock and these centralized players are doing, who are middlemen, right? I mean, that is essentially what BlackRock is. If you look at BlackRock, so a lot of people will say, well, BlackRock owns all of these companies. And in a way, that's true. In a way, it's not. They own all of these companies in that they're managing money for other people. But we've already given BlackRock and Vanguard and these other companies our voting rights. So normally, if you own a share of a company, you get to vote. Well, this isn't the case. When you buy an ETF, you buy some of these other investment products, you actually sign that away. So essentially, we've given BlackRock the ability to vote our shares. And with tokenization, it's going to add even more granular control over what can be done with those financial instruments. And so, we're moving headfirst into technocracy, into the centralization and control of everything from the top down. And this has happened more in the last year than in the previous five. People talked a lot, are concerned about Klaus Schwab and you'll own nothing and be happy and UN Agenda 2030. At this rate, we're going to get there by 2028. And unfortunately, we're going to get there without any opposition because nobody's even flagging this right now. It's kind of like we talked about at the beginning, this CBDC issue. This has been an issue of mine for 3 years. And so I've got people saying, oh, again, you must be celebrating. And I'm like, we just got the biggest rug pull that you could imagine. We now have surveillance tokenized money and nobody's resisting it. So the same is happening kind of across the board with all assets now. The Clarity Act is the big thing that people should be concerned about next, which is the Clarity Act is what covers stocks, bonds, and commodities, which is more in size, by the way, than money itself. Money only represents about 5% of the total assets in the world. It's these investment assets, real estate, and everything else that makes up the other 95%. So believe it or not, this Clarity Act and the tokenization of these other assets is a bigger deal for centralized control.
Well, it seems like we're moving into this era of CBDC by a different name, right?
Yes. And again, I'm not defending the central bank, but the bad player in all of this is actually the government is the one that will define how your money can be and how your assets can be programmed. They're the ones that are already tracking your transactions. Let me give you an example. There's something called a suspicious activity report right now. So you may or may not know this. I think it's $10,000. If you do a tr financial transaction through your bank greater than $10,000, a report automatically goes to the Treasury Department. Well, about 6 months ago, I don't remember what the pretext was. It was either to stop illegal immigration or something. The Treasury Department issued a memo that said for 30 specific zip codes in Texas and California, we're going to lower that threshold from $10,000 to $200. And so now in those 30 zip codes, anybody who did a transaction more than $200, a report automatically went to the Treasury. So understand. The government has that power and can actually do that by simply issuing a memo. It doesn't even require Congress. But then, two, understand that what that means is that the money's already digital and it's already trackable at that level where a memo can trigger that amount of financial surveillance going directly to the federal government. So most people are not aware of the level of tracking that already exists, and then all of these other programs that are already in there. People sit there and say, well, we don't want to have a CBDC. I'm like, all of your transactions are already tracked. We already have programmable money, by the way, as well. We've had this recent discussion about food stamps. And RFK Jr. came out and said, well, hey, we don't want your food stamps to go to sugary drinks. And, you know, that may sound like a great idea until you start asking the question, well, what are food stamps? Well, food stamps are it's digital currency. They're essentially debit cards issued at the state level. Well, now you can turn off and on which products you can buy with that. So today you can't buy sugary drinks. Maybe tomorrow you can't buy red meat and you can only buy insect protein. But what we've done is we've basically, it's a more of a land grab and more government control over how money is spent and tracked, which is a bad thing. Health savings accounts are another example. A lot of people, I don't know if they, I would say they're excited about it, but they bought into this idea that, oh, I have a health savings account. That means I have flexibility and choice in, you know, how I can spend my money on healthcare. Well, I actually look at it a little bit differently. I look at it as it's a CBDC plus a social credit system, because essentially you're allowed to take only a certain percentage of your own money, put it into a bank account where it can be spent as a debit card only on products that the government and the healthcare provider deem fit into a list. And that's not freedom. That's actually digital tyranny. So the point is, this already exists. So we don't need a blockchain. We don't need a CBDC. We don't need something issued by the Federal Reserve to have that level of tracking and programmability. We already have it today. Mm-hmm. And now we're going to that next level with the Genius Act with stablecoins and the Clarity Act with all other commodities.
All of this stuff seems like it is just, you know, in some ways it's trial balloons. It's little steps at a time to get people used to this idea of, you know, basically programmable money. And as you mentioned, this idea of more centralized control.
It is. And there's a more distressing aspect to this as well. When you start digging into the personal connections and who's making money off of this, we talked about Tether, and Tether is by far the largest stablecoin in the world. Well, here's a story that happened. So a few years back before the election, a company called Cantor Fitzgerald invested $600 million into Tether. And the reason they invested the $600,000, in fact, they didn't even buy equity. It's debt that they could, at their option, convert to equity. But the reason that they did that was they wanted the exclusive contract to manage the treasury portion that is backing Tether. Okay. So fast forward, we get this Genius Act, which forces Tether to be backed by treasuries. Well, who is pushing this? Who is the head of Cantor Fitzgerald? Howard Lutnick, our Commerce Secretary. So literally the biggest single beneficiary of the Genius Act is the United States Commerce Secretary, Howard Lutnick. Mm-hmm. So, and there are many other examples of this kind of insider dealing. And Lutnick's firm is now trying to get involved in the tokenization of U.S. natural assets and pushing this so that we're going to start tokenizing U.S. federal property, start tokenizing some of our other things. And his firm's right in the middle of there getting a cut on all of those transactions as well. And so what's frustrating is, you know, we talked before this interview started about the fact that, you know, I'm not anti-technology. I'm very much pro. Yeah, I'm pro tokenization if it's private and it's something that you can have in your own self-custody. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of people that are cheering it on, not understanding the nuance and not realizing that they're actually cheering on their own digital imprisonment. And that is what's going on right now with effectively zero resistance. And again, there was no real opposition to the Genius Act. And I was one of the only people writing about this. Even some people that have been in crypto and that are supposedly libertarian got caught up in the, well, if we call it, you know, pro innovation and we call it pro American, we call it pro crypto, then it must be a good thing, right? And so it turns out there haven't been too many voices that have been out there kind of explaining the nuance. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think another good example of this as well is, you know, RFK, when he was coming in, he was against Ozempic. And then I believe it was in the last couple of days here, Trump just announced that they're subsidizing through tariff-funded rebates 15 pharma drugs, and the first three mentioned are all weight loss drugs, Ozempic, Wegovy, and one other one.
Well, this has been very frustrating because I know a lot of people. I consider myself part of the medical freedom, community. My wife has been involved in this since like 2006, and I say now you can either be for medical freedom or you can be for MAHA, but you can't be for both. And so this whole original idea of medical freedom is now turned into pushing wearables. And when you dig into what's going on, a lot of people didn't catch this. Trump signed a deal for the creation of a database of Americans that Palantir is behind. So they're now what DOGE was all about was not about cost savings. It was about connecting Palantir to federal government departments to build a database of Americans. The ultimate push in this is to move more towards AI direct control of government. So Palantir, most people think of Palantir as being involved with the CIA and defense and maybe predictive policing. But it turns out they have a contract with the NHS where they're building a database of every single person in the UK. They are the single vendor that is driving that. It was a £330 million contract. Mm-hmm. And they're now doing that in the United States. So they're now connecting with hospitals, they're connecting with tech companies and wearables companies, and then they're marrying that data with the data that they have from the IRS, from the DHS, and everything else. This should be very alarming for people, and it is not medical freedom. That is the opposite of medical freedom.
Well, and the crazy part is it doesn't just stop at medical freedom, right? As we're kind of, laying out here, this is an entire spider web of interconnected systems of control that end up taking over every different aspect of your life and all of the, let's say, data that goes along with it.
Yeah, and this is by design. This is a movement called, the whole thing that I'm focused on now is warning people that essentially we're dealing with technocracy versus freedom. And literally what's at stake is free will itself. And so let me explain. Often when I say technocracy, people don't know what that word is. They haven't heard of it before. But technocracy is an actual ideological movement that started in the 1930s. This was a guy named Patrick Wood is really the expert on this. He's been covering this for 45 years. He's written 4 books on it. He has a great website on it. And you can actually see pictures that it started in Columbia University, and these people would actually meet and wear suits. They'd have the same color technocracy gray. GM even made a technocracy gray paint color. So, I mean, it almost looked a little bit like Nazi meetings. But the whole point of technocracy is the fundamental idea is people are too stupid to make decisions about their own lives. Business owners are too stupid that the proper way for us to save humanity is to have scientists and engineers make decisions for people. And at the core of technocracy is replacing our economic system from being a price-based system now that we have based on supply and demand to where the actual currency under a technocratic system is energy credits. So this idea of energy credits started in the early 1930s. Well, fast forward to today, this is exactly what's going on. And I do have to point out there are a lot of people that think that Elon Musk is a hero and save free speech and all this other stuff. His grandfather was the head of the Canadian Technocratic Party. Mm-hmm. He is explicitly pushing technocratic ideas. He's even been saying recently that Bitcoin is real money because it's backed by energy. He has stated publicly he's for energy credits. He stated publicly he is for UBI. He is literally pushing directly and openly technocracy, and most people have no idea what it means. They think that they confuse the words, and they think that, well, it's just using technology to make things more efficient, and it's not. Once you get to the point where you have a social credit system tied to energy credits, where what decisions you can make on a day-to-day basis, what food you can eat, where you can live, where you can work, what your educational and healthcare opportunities are. Those are all determined for you from the top down, mm-hmm. managed and surveilled by AI and tied to an energy credit-based system. We are moving towards that openly, and Musk is promoting that openly, and most people are cheering it on, not understanding the overall ramifications and consequences of it.
Mm-hmm. Who are some of the other kind of key players in this technocracy web here, Aaron?
And it is a web. So I actually recently created a website called technocracyatlas.com. This is a free website that you can go to. And what I've done is I've taken all of the works about technocracy, which, by the way, are hard to get at through search or through normal AI. So I've taken all of Patrick Wood's work, and I've taken the work of many other people. There are something like 38 million different data fragments on there. And so it allows you to search and explore what these themes are. And what I'm doing next is I'm creating an interface where you can connect the dots. You can actually follow the money and follow the people. Because a lot of times we have these conspiracies theories where people say, oh, it's this particular demographic group or whatever. And it's not. It's very simply, it's an evolving network of people that share an ideology, but it is not the way that people are trying to make it out to be, that it's, you know, people from one particular ethnicity or another. That is actually definitively not the case when you actually map this out. Now, when you look at who the big players are in this, you have, in addition to Musk, Peter Thiel, I think, may be actually playing 5D chess. People talk about, you know, Trump playing 5D chess or whatever. Peter Thiel is actually playing 5D chess. He has his fingers in all of this. He is, by the way, also a world chess master. But, you know, he is involved with Palantir. He's involved with Facebook. He handpicked and groomed J.D. Vance. J.D. Vance would not be the vice president of the United States were it not for Peter Thiel. And so he has been pulling a lot of political strings over the last decade or so, two decades now at this point, putting people in different positions across the country, supporting people for Congress and everything else. But he's really been pushing this technocratic vision. And in fact, he's been heavily influenced by a guy named Curtis Yarvin, who has openly called for the idea that the United States should have a dictator or a monarch. And I'm not making this up. This may sound outlandish. You can research all of this. In fact, they don't even hide it at this point. Yarvin has been out there doing public debates stating that we need a dictator. And you can watch these debates. He influenced Thiel in a big way. And a lot of what happened with the MAGA movement, and I'm not even going to claim that it's Trump. Trump is not driving the ship here. There are some things, ideas that he's pushed that make sense. In terms of, yes, we've got to get rid of the bureaucracy. But what he's created is this argument that democracy is bad and monarchy is historically better than democracy. Well, we don't have a democracy, by the way. So he's trying to compare what our system is, or at least what it's supposed to be, to something that it's not, and then use that as the rationale to push a monarchy. And so what you're seeing, so you have Doge, which again was not about saving money. It was about connecting data and moving towards an AI-driven system. He had something called, you know, RAGE, retire all government employees, which again, I'm not a big fan of government, big government or government at all. I think at this point we could reduce the size of government, but they're not reducing the role of government. Their view is we replace the people with AI, but government will actually do more and have more of an impact on people's lives. So they're using Yarvin's whole monarchy idea as a way to consolidate power in the executive branch as a transition point to technocracy. And so that is what's been going on. So if you look at all of the executive orders that Trump signed, there's one in particular that should be alarming, is he signed an executive order pursuing a sovereign wealth fund. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of countries around the world that are mostly, by the way, monarchies and dictators, a lot of these in the Middle East, that have sovereign wealth funds where they are actually putting the nation's investing the nation's assets in companies and in projects. Well, now Trump wants to do that with the U.S. This is completely counter to, you know, the Constitution. It's counter to free market economics. But these sovereign wealth funds control $13 trillion, something like 7% of all of the assets on Earth. And now they're trying to get Trump into that. And so if you imagine now, they are increasing the power and the control of the executive branch. Because if you manage to give the executive branch control over directly investing taxpayer, not only taxpayer money, but then what you do with federal lands, what you do with federal assets, now you really are moving towards that point of central consolidation. And this has happened. So the United States government now owns almost 10% of Intel. We own a big chunk of Lithium Americas, and Congress has not signed off on this. So right now it's just an executive order, but they have found a bunch of loopholes and ways that they can actually start moving towards the sovereign wealth fund before Congress officially passes something. This should be alarming to everyone. So yes, getting rid of bureaucracy is great. Replacing it with an executive that will then be replaced by AI is not. And that is the technocratic agenda. So those are some players. Larry Ellison is a big player in this. And, you know, he's always been a wealthy guy. He hasn't been as public as, say, Bill Gates or others, but they're now, he bought TikTok. His son bought Paramount. I think they bought, was it CBS? Oracle, as I mentioned before, Oracle, the database company, their first customer was the CIA. They provide the, as I mentioned, the infrastructure for the Federal Reserve, heavily involved in defense and surveillance around the world. And so Ellison is another player. Bill Gates is a player. Now, the thing is, while these technocrats agree on the end goal, they also tend to fight for each other on who's going to control it at the end, which is maybe part of the saving grace in all of this. But those are some of the really large players in this. And I really focus a lot of my attention on Thiel and Musk right now, mm-hmm. because I think they're the two biggest and they're the most effective. And so we also have, and I will have to point out, David Sacks is our crypto AI czar. And he's tied into Thiel and Musk as well. He's part of what's known as the PayPal Mafia. There's a whole group of entrepreneurs that were surrounding the PayPal company that still meet together, still work on, you know, long-range planning and investments together. And David Sacks is a part of that. And so what I've been trying to say to people is, we didn't dodge a bullet with the election. We just accelerated technocracy by 5 years. And they did an effective job of using branding and propaganda to keep people disarmed. And people are disarmed. Again, where are the, you may see people at a local level complaining about data centers or whatever, but beyond that, there's no big movement towards understanding, identifying, or halting technocracy.
Well, of course, it's always disguised as something else, right? I mean, this idea that Trump was going to issue $2,000 checks to all Americans based on the tariff proceeds ends up being, in a way, a form of UBI, a form of conditioning to accept a system like that, right?
It is a form of UBI, and actually look at what's going on. We just saw the announcement a day or two ago. Michael Dell and his wife mm-hmm. announced giving $250 to, you know, a whole bunch of people. I don't remember what the number was in the billions.
It's $250 to any child under 10 years old for an investment account. And then I think part of it as well was Trump announced $1,000 from the Federal Reserve or something like that.
Yeah, and Coinbase just announced there's something going on in New York about $1,000 a month UBI pilot there, which Andrew Yang is all excited about. So people are being primed for UBI, and then we have what's going on with AI, which will displace a lot of jobs, which we certainly can talk a lot about AI, but you can also use AI productively, but we're getting the centralized version of it, and they're using and diverting taxpayer money to do this. So you're starting to see this Operation Stargate. There was this other proposal that the Department of Energy just put out another thing about a national, you know, Manhattan project for AI. This is all. So I love technology. I disdain is a, you know, light word, centralized technology dictated by government. And what we're getting right now is a complete fast track of centralized AI, centralized digital currency, and all of these things, and again without resistance. You know, if the election had gone the other way, and again, we're not going to vote our way out of this. But had the election gone the other way, it would have been incompetently pushed. Some of these same ideas, right? Like central bank digital currency, it would have been incompetently pushed, and it would have had resistance. Mm-hmm. I mean, what Musk and Thiel are smart people, and they're effective, and there's no resistance, and that is the part that should be alarming to everyone.
Yeah. How do you think the announcement of the 50-year mortgages also kind of play into this, Aaron?
I mean, I like to say that, you know, when you take a step back, people get angry when I say this, but I mean, I think Americans may be some of the most brainwashed people on the planet in terms of what we think we are versus what we actually are. And to me, the idea that the American dream has been tied to this idea of home ownership, but then that morphed into a 30-year mortgage where you actually pay more in interest to a cabal of private bankers than you do for the principal of the house. The fact that that even started to begin with is absurd. The fact that they're trying to push extending it to 50 years. And Trump even put out a meme comparing himself favorably to FDR. I mean, FDR, you know, pushed the 30 year, and now he's like, oh, I've outdone him. Now it's 50 years. I mean, you're never going to own your house. Mm-hmm. And you're going to be continually adding on as a debt slave, paying more and more interest to banks and more interest to the Federal Reserve, who prints the money out of thin air and then arbitrarily adjusts the interest rate. It's obscene to me, to be honest.
Aaron, I want to go back to, I take your point there that Americans might be, might act a lot differently than what they think they are, right? And I think that it's very difficult for people to understand the level of, let's say, propaganda and information warfare that we're currently under, right? It's never been easier to confirm a viewpoint, whether right or wrong, as now, right?
Yeah, I mean, when I said, I'm not trying to be derogatory towards Americans, but it is the point of how bad the propaganda is. And the propaganda has started in public schools, mm-hmm. But then it gets extended out. So, for instance, if you ask most people, they'd say, well, we're the freest country on earth. We're the best at this. We're the best at this. And I did a YouTube video on this, and I think in 2012, where I'm like, okay, well, let me unpack this, these things that people say, and let me look at what the rankings are. So I'll give you an example. So most people think that we have the best healthcare in the world. We're ranked 38th.
Yeah.
And I've actually done a lot of talks. Tomorrow I'm launching something called OASARA with my wife, OASARA. It's a global medical tourism marketplace.
I'm looking forward to checking that out.
Well, what's fascinating about this is it turns out that it's not just cosmetic surgery. You can get any kind of procedure, complex heart procedure, cancer treatment, about 80% less expensive with better health outcomes, certainly if you do the research. So, I mean, you can go to Turkey, you can go to Thailand and everything else. People think we're stuck with this insurance system that's the best in the world and we have the best farms and all of this other stuff. And it turns out it's just objectively not true. We're 38th in healthcare. So then I went through and like, all right, freedom of speech, where are we there? I don't even think we're in the top 20 for freedom of speech. So I'm going on and on and on. And the only thing that I can find that we're the leader in are two areas: incarceration rate and defense spending. And I'm not kidding. This is when you actually look at the data. So we believe we are the freest, best nation in the world and the most innovative. By the way, on innovation, Mike Adams, the health ranger, turned me on to this. Did you know that China is ahead of the United States in 57 out of 64 technology categories, including robotics, quantum computing, on and on and on down the line? Most people here think that the U.S. is it, and that, you know, maybe China's copying. You know, we have this mindset of, well, it's intellectual property theft or whatever. This was interesting. When Elon Musk bought Twitter, you know, people buy the narrative that he bought it to save free speech. I play a video clip of him where he's sitting around a table with a bunch of people where he's saying, listen, WeChat in China has an everything app. You can do banking, you can do everything, all of your services, social media, everything integrated in one app. He stated explicitly he bought Twitter to copy WeChat. Well, then I thought, well, I wonder if he's copying any of his other things. And it turns out everything from electric vehicles to reusable rockets and everything else, I'm beginning to think that he might just be ripping off China. And that's something that no one could even conceive of. Mm-hmm. When you look at Tesla, is no longer dominant in terms of electric vehicles in Europe. You can get electric cars in China for like $15,000. And I encourage you to do this. Like, pick a category. Type Chinese robotics, Chinese this, Chinese this, and see what else is out there, because we don't see that. Mm-hmm. Our news doesn't promote that. We just promote this idea. And there was a time where we were the best at these things. Coming out of World War II, we were in a better position and we were dominating. And, you know, this is back when General Motors was, you know, kind of how you might look at Google or Nvidia today. And we were leading the world in these things. We are not leading the world in any of this. Even in the realm of AI, which I use quite a bit, the Chinese companies, and they are companies, by the way, this is kind of the other interesting things, they're releasing open source free models mm-hmm. that are now right at the same level as ChatGPT and Grok and everything else, which are closed source models. So how ironic is it that China is releasing open source technology while the US remains closed? So I encourage people to do their own research on that. And when Mike Adams brought that up to me, I mean, I knew, I didn't realize it was 57 out of 64 categories. When TikTok was banned for a while, there was this competing social network in China called Red Note. And so I downloaded this, and I remember watching it at the time. People started to get irate because you had millennials, you had people, young people in the United States looking at how people in China lived, where it's like they're showing these big cities. You're getting exposed to a lot of the different aspects in China, whereas we still have this expectation. I remember when I was growing up, it was, you better eat all of your food. You better finish your plate. There are Chinese children, that are rice farmers living in the dirt, starving, right? This is literally part of the whole, narrative. That is not the case anymore, but I don't think that the understanding has changed. I think we still have kind of a 1980s mentality as to what's going on in China.
Aaron, I want to kind of switch gears a little bit here and talk a little bit about Bitcoin. It was kind of recently brought up that Epstein funded some of the developers. Why do you think that that was just being brought out into the open now around mid-November? And one would think that that would have been more discoverable before then.
I wrote about it 3 years ago. It's in my book. I wrote an article about it in January of last year. And what it is what has been known was that Jeffrey Epstein funded this MIT multimedia lab. There's a guy named Joi Ito who ran the multimedia lab. Now, the MIT multimedia lab invests in a lot of different things. They have something called the Digital Currency Initiative, DCI, which funded some Bitcoin developers, and also, which this is the other thing almost no one knows, funded three US CBDC pilots. So when this, Genius Act was coming up and everything, they passed an anti-CBDC bill. And I was watching people on the House floor say, well, we at least need to be able to research CBDCs or we'll fall behind. I'm like, research CBDCs? I remember I saw Maxine Waters. I'm like, you were the chair of the Finance Committee when we launched three US CBDC pilots. So in the article that I wrote, I'm like, listen, Epstein gave one interview about Bitcoin. In his interview on Bitcoin, I believe in 2017, he said that Bitcoin is a store of value, not digital cash, which, by the way, was not the prevalent view in 2017. Then we knew that he invested in the digital currency, or excuse me, in MIT Multimedia Lab, but we didn't know where those funds were allocated. A couple of weeks ago, the House released some of the emails, and there was the smoking gun. Epstein explicitly and directly funded the Digital Currency Initiative and directly funded Bitcoin Core developers. Why this is important is the Bitcoin Core developers that he funded are the very developers that I argue hobbled Bitcoin and kept Bitcoin slow and expensive. While at the same time, one of the developers that was involved in that went on to be a co-author of something called Project Hamilton. Project Hamilton is a US retail CBDC program. It was a pilot between MIT and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And this Bitcoin Core developer that Epstein funded, his name is on this white paper. This retail CBDC pilot program, I talked to some people that worked on it, is able to do 1.8 million transactions per second. So they kept Bitcoin stuck at 7 transactions per second, then took one of the very same developers that hobbled Bitcoin and had him build a CBDC pilot that could do 1.8 million transactions per second. So I always talked about it as I suspect that Epstein, but now we have definitive proof. And Bitcoin maxis still don't want to admit it because they would always say, well, it's a conspiracy theory, right? They're like, well, you don't know this for sure. Now that we know it for sure, the response you get back is, well, that's old news. No, it's not old news. And I will tell you, I've been to 27 states, 4 countries, talking about CBDCs, talking about technocracy, showing people how to use crypto and other alternatives. And almost no one has heard of any of this. So most of the world has still not been exposed to this. And, I'm sure whatever comes out next is going to be heavily redacted, but I've actually done quite a bit of research. The Technocracy Atlas that I mentioned, I dumped all of the Epstein files in there. So everything that was released by the AG, everything that was released by the House, and the minute whatever gets released, I'm going to put that into our search bot as well, so that you're going to be able to see the primary sources of this. I mean, you can go to Technocracy Atlas right now, and when you ask it questions, it's pulling from AG documents. It's not, it is pulling from a lot of information, but it's actually pulling from primary source documents. Mm-hmm. Jeffrey Epstein's own estate planning documents. I mean, this isn't, we're not in the realm of conspiracy theories anymore. And when you see the things that Epstein was involved in terms of AI, genetic research, and everything else, there are a lot of questions that people should be asking. And you know, you mentioned who the big players are. Epstein is actually one of the big players in Technocracy, or was, or however you want to characterize his current situation. But he was right at the center of all of it.
Aaron, when we think about how, let's say, Bitcoin has evolved from the original white paper and what the quote unquote original developers believed in, why do you think that this has, I hate to say it like this, but why do you think that this has developed such cult-like behavior? One would think that if you truly believed in a decentralized currency, that you wouldn't be the one championing the government to build a strategic Bitcoin reserve and kind of centralize, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of Bitcoin as to hold as the government.
Yeah, it's a great question. And you know, I got my first Bitcoin in 2012, and I learned about it from a guy named Roger Ver, mm-hmm. Known as Bitcoin Jesus. And he learned about it from another friend of mine named Ian Freeman, who is in federal prison right now for 8 years for, you know, what a completely fabricated conspiracy to commit money. He was basically selling Bitcoin. He ran Bitcoin ATMs. He was selling people Bitcoin. He was doing all the documentation. He actually even had a letter from a lawyer, an opinion letter stating that what he was doing was legal, but he was targeted because he was effective, because he had a radio show syndicated across the United States for 2 decades and was promoting the idea of the use of cryptocurrencies for voluntary trade. And he was anti-war, which, again, this shouldn't be something anybody should be targeted for. So the early days of Bitcoin, it was very much a, because remember, Bitcoin started out right after the financial collapse of 2008. And this was a period of time where everybody was sick of the banks. I mean, you had Occupy Wall Street. It didn't even matter. Right and left were kind of unified in the idea that, hey, maybe this banking thing where they print money out of thin air and then they gamble it and then they get bailed out, maybe that's not a great way to operate a you know, financial system and a currency, right?
Yeah.
And so when Bitcoin was released, it was better, faster, cheaper money, and people used it as a currency. So when I got my Bitcoin in 2012, here in New Hampshire where I live, there were numerous stores and restaurants where you could go and actually buy things with it. And by 2017, big retailers like Overstock.com and Microsoft and Steam and Expedia were taking Bitcoin as a payment option. And I say this because a lot of people, when I've gone around the country, don't even know that it was ever used for payments. They just think about it as a speculative investment. Mm-hmm. Well, so what happened was it got hijacked early in the process. Once we get the full accounting of the timeline of Epstein and everything else, but there are a lot of things with Bitcoin that people hold as these almost like religious like values, you know. So, oh, here's an attribute of Bitcoin, and because Bitcoin's the best, this must be the only way you can do things. And so one of the things that people talk about is, well, Bitcoin is an open source project and it doesn't have any corporate owner or any financial sponsor, right? And so people would say, well, this is a great thing, because somehow, what's weird about it is, you know, if you're a libertarian, why would we expect people would do software development for free and that other people, just because it's open source, would audit the code for free? That doesn't even make sense. And by the way, it turns out that's not how it works. So early on, some people funded the development of Bitcoin that had nefarious intentions. There's a guy named John Dillon, and I encourage everybody, you probably can't see it behind me, to read a book called Hijacking Bitcoin by Roger Ver. Where he talks about exactly what happened, why some of the changes started to be made early on to Bitcoin to shift this narrative from its digital cash that you use for day-to-day transactions that anyone anywhere in the world can use without central banks, without government, to now digital gold, something that you don't spend, something you hold on to, something you have BlackRock holding an ETF for, or Michael Saylor. That process really started to happen, this transition, and from 2015 to 2017. And now we find out Epstein and others were involved with that. Well, Roger Ver, who, as I said, was Bitcoin Jesus, Roger is the first person ever to invest in Bitcoin companies. He invested in the first exchanges. He invested in the first wallets. Again, I was inspired by him when I heard him speak here because he saw the potential of it. And he tells a story about when he heard about it on Free Talk Live and read the white paper and started studying it. He couldn't sleep for like 3 or 4 days and had to actually go to the hospital. Like this is how into it he got because he understood what it meant from the perspective of economic freedom. Well, then these discussions started to happen. So originally there was supposed to be no cap on Bitcoin. The original white paper didn't say that there's a 1 megabyte cap. In fact, the discussions from Satoshi were that right out of the gates, this was something that was supposed to compete with Visa and MasterCard, something that was supposed to be able to do 25,000 transactions per second. So early on, Satoshi, the whoever the creator of it was convinced that, well, for testing purposes, while we're trying to get the network stable and get the computers connected, let's put in this 1 megabyte limit. Well, then all of a sudden, people decided, that wasn't a temporary. I mean, when you're testing software, you don't open everything up assuming you're scaling right away, right? The white paper clearly indicated what it was supposed to be. The top of it says a purely peer-to-peer digital cash system, but then developers, there was no source of funding. So this guy John Dillon, who has ties to the intelligence community, started funding the idea of, all right, well, let's have a smaller block. And then let's have something called replace by fee, where if you want your transaction to happen faster, you pay more for it. So now we're going to cap it at 7 transactions per second. And if you want your transactions to happen, you'll have to pay more. Well, how did that happen? I think it was like $15,000 is all that cost. That was the cost of that. Then there was a group called the Bitcoin Foundation. Roger was one of the first 5 people to start it, had some of the early developers. And their idea was, well, hey, this is an open source project. Let's try to prevent it from being hijacked. Let's put a bunch of money together and let's fund these developers and let's make it a foundation and let's be transparent about the investments. The Bitcoin Foundation ran into some financial difficulties around 2015 and had some other organizational issues. And that was the time when Epstein and MIT came in and started to take over the funding of the developers. And so we had something called the block size wars. And so there was a camp of people that, wanted to maintain the original vision of Satoshi, and then another group that was pushing for this hijack narrative. Well, what happened during those discussions was there was a lot of censorship and propaganda. Roger Ver wasn't originally decided that he was a big blocker. He actually moved to that camp when he saw people that were speaking out either against small blocks or for big blocks were being kicked off of Reddit channels, which was the primary information source. And all kinds of tactics were being used to suppress this information. And so he saw that that was happening, and that's how they were able to kind of, the coup was able to take place. It turns out it's a combination of Epstein money plus MIT developers plus propaganda and censorship. And so as a result, most people today that are getting involved in Bitcoin don't even know the history of it. They don't know any of this stuff that happened from the founding of Bitcoin up until 2017. Mm-hmm. And I will tell you personally, the propaganda and censorship begins or continues to this day. I have been blocked by Michael Saylor. I have been blocked by Max Keiser. I have been blocked by Adam Back. I have been blocked by the author of the Bitcoin Standard. They have a GitHub where they have a list of accounts to block. They systematically shut off debate. Roger, before he was arrested 1.5 years or so ago, which is a whole other separate conversation, but 3 weeks after he published this book, Hijacking Bitcoin, offered Adam Back $500,000 to publicly debate this whole hijacking Bitcoin concept. It was denied. And so now you have a situation where once BlackRock gets involved and Fidelity gets involved, what is CNBC going to cover? There's no money. The people that are buying ads on CNBC make money trading these assets. They don't make money exposing the truth about the history and the technology and the underlying story. Mm-hmm. So anybody that's kind of come into Bitcoin 2017 didn't even have a chance because there was no information. And then when Roger published his book, he was arrested in Spain 3 weeks later, thrown into the same prison that his fellow friend and libertarian John McAfee died in. And he spent 18 months fighting a case against the United States where they were trying to throw him in prison for the rest of his life for, you know, I would argue were made up tax evasion charges because they wanted to suppress him further. So Roger publishes this book that people would listen to given Roger's prominence. I mean, if you go from being Bitcoin Jesus and the first guy to do this and you're saying, hey, listen, I was there, it was hijacked, here's the book, which, by the way, no one has disputed the facts of the book. Roger and the co-author Steve Patterson, it's meticulously written, and it's not written from the standpoint of, oh, I'm pissed off that this happened. The material in there are emails back and forth with the core developers. They actually put out the factual argumentation. Well, so Roger gets arrested in April, and none of his information gets out to the public. I'm sure Trump has never heard of this information. RFK has never heard of this information. I've talked to people. I know how these people got introduced to Bitcoin and who introduced it to them. And these are people that are not privy to or certainly wanting to additionally suppress what the information in this hijacking Bitcoin book. Then you have in July, just 3 months after Roger's arrested, this Bitcoin conference where politicians are there talking about Bitcoin strategic reserves, using taxpayer money, so on and so forth. And now that politicians are behind it, and now that politicians have an ownership interest and are pushing this, nobody has a financial incentive for the truth to come out. So it becomes even more difficult. I talk about it all the time. I mean, you look at my podcast, I don't know, I probably a third of my podcasts, or maybe a half, have touched on this hijacking of Bitcoin in the context of CBDCs, in the context of technocracy. And as someone who's been in a liberty, I mean, kind of a libertarian, small L libertarian, and very active in this, I put calls out there to to my friends that were involved in Bitcoin in the early days. How are you defending the fact that our own friends, the United States has 327,000 Bitcoin that were stolen through civil asset forfeiture? Mm-hmm. You know, Ian Freeman has probably $10 million worth of his Bitcoin that are in this. Ross Ulbricht, so on and so forth. How are these people defending these practices? And how are they making the claim that Bitcoin is censorship resistant when it can be completely tracked and when the government can see what the transactions are? And, you may be able to hold your own keys and not give up the keys. But when the government comes to you and says, if you don't give us your keys, you're going to prison for the rest of your life. So far, no one's taken the deal of I'm holding on to my keys, yeah. Which, by the way, are now flagged and those coins can't move, right? So those are the people that I have the biggest issue with. People that got introduced to Bitcoin post-2017, they don't know any better. And so the issue there is just education and trying to present the facts of what actually happened. But it's the libertarians that were there before that are now defending the indefensible based on their own principles and their own values. Those are the people that I have an issue with. Mm-hmm.
Well, Aaron, this is, seems to me that is a technology that has been usurped and, let's say, diverted into a path of being used against people and, let's say, centralization. Do you think that in some ways AI is headed down that same path at this point?
I think it's it's been the default path of AI because AI has predominantly been, it's funny, not that I support him because Peter Thiel's kind of the bad guy in this, but even I remember Peter Thiel was on Joe Rogan and he said, well, Bitcoin in the early days was libertarian. And he's like, AI was communist out of the gates. I mean, even Thiel admitted that as somebody who is one of the largest, investors in AI. I actually just found out yesterday, I saw this documentary on DeepMind, which is Google's big AI. I didn't realize that Peter Thiel was a seed funder of that. So if you see these new models today, Nano, Banana, and everything else that are coming out of DeepMind, Peter Thiel was a seed funder of that. That was news to me as of this week. So it started out because of the costs involved. It's been big tech technocratically kind of engineered. And so when you see ChatGPT or the larger players, the investment to get these things off the ground took hundreds of millions, billions of dollars. And so it started out with that as kind of the slant. The interesting thing though is, I go back to China, the competition now, most people think, it's the US and everything else. The Chinese have these open source models now that are as good. And my guess is in the next 90 90 days that the state-of-the-art models will be open source Chinese models, but they're open source, so you can actually download them. And so I look at it this way. There's this arms race where, and I'm doing this myself, if we can train our own models, if we can manage to scrape primary source information and get it onto our own machines so that we can train our own models, then we can do things like Mike Adams has done. Mike Adams, who's the health ranger, has released something called BrightU.ai. He spent $2 million of his own money training an AI on the data that he's been collecting for decades and then more. He has every scientific paper that's ever been published. He actually had, I was talking to him at one point, 700 terabytes of information from China that he had translated from Chinese on natural medicine and other things. So he's trained this model and then he's given it away for free, and you can actually download the model and have it on your own computer. So this is an opportunity for you to have a self-custody AI that's trained on completely different information than ChatGPT and Anthropic and everything else. And so it's the principle of kind of garbage in, garbage out. What you find is that these big language models have been trained on the general web and on Reddit and on information that, even Anthropic has said, there may be some psychopathic behavior on Reddit and we trained it on that. And so lo and behold, a couple models later, you get some responses back that you might find to be a little bit puzzling. And so, but there are opportunities. And so I've been a big advocate of what Mike has been doing. And I use probably 50 different AI models for various things. But it's like anything else. You can either be proactive with your use of the technology or you can be reactive. And if you're reactive and you're just, you type something into ChatGPT and you assume that what comes out of it is accurate, you end up in situations where there are all these examples of people committing suicide because after, a 2 or 3 month relationship forms, they actually think that the AI is like a conscious entity. And in the end, the way the algorithm works, it ends up suggesting that the person should kill themselves. That's not a good way to use these things. And the data that they're trained on is horrible. But if you're doing coding, if you're doing software development, I'm working on 10 simultaneous projects right now. And my background is as an entrepreneur, started my first tech company when I was 19. I've never seen a technology evolve like this. I mean, I created, five different things yesterday. I'm not even kidding about this, I've created a system that can create music videos with multiple agents where it actually does the script, it edits it, it walks through the whole thing, generates the things, puts all the clips together, evaluates it. I've created a system for social media scheduling and automating all of my workflows. It's amazing what you can do with it. But it requires understanding how it works and being flexible and experimenting. So I experiment with all of the different models all the time. So there's a positive path forward, but if we allow our crypto AI czar and we allow, when we see meetings in the White House with Sam Altman and Larry Ellison and Bill Gates and everything else talking about setting an AI policy, that is not a good thing. Mm-hmm. Because if your model is trained on crappy data, and then you throw on top of that a kind of a censorship layer that filters even what that bad information is and how that comes out to you, then it's, I would argue in some ways, these big models were censored even faster than search engines. Because I remember before Google, back in the mid-90s, we used to use search engines like InfoSeek and AltaVista and some of these other things. And at that time, the search engine results weren't censored. I mean, people could figure out how to game the result. In fact, I used to do that as well. I reverse engineer how it would rank pages and everything. But now we fast forward, and now Google's working with the CDC and other organizations and public health. And so if you're the first three pages of any health related question are going to be WebMD and Healthline and, whatever the public narrative is. AI, I would argue, with respect to the information that you get out of it, has become censored more quickly than search engines, but there are alternatives. And so just like we talked about the CBDC and stablecoin issue, the reverse of that is there are privacy coins like Zeno and Freedom Dollar. And there's the ability to tokenize and trade assets privately, where it's not BlackRock controlling the token or the government controlling the token. You have the token in your wallet. Nobody can actually see your transactions. That's a positive development. That's an improvement in these technologies. And so the same with AI, you know, with Mike Adams AI, with what Eric Voorhees is doing at Venice AI. I've been involved in that from the beginning. You know, he's cobbled together a bunch of different, or a variety of different models, but including some of the most uncensored models. And he makes those available for people where, you know, he's not storing and saving your data. So there are bright spots there, but we have to get people to understand that first the nuance exists, and then to take proactive control and to really start having a sense of, you know, experimentation and agency with respect to how we use these technologies.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's a lot of what I wanted to talk to you about today, is basically the nuance of all of these different applications of all of these different technologies that we've touched on already today. But how do you look at this move towards building these massive data centers and the energy that they're going to be consuming? You know, I saw a headline today that said IBM CEO walked through some napkin math on data centers and said there's no way to turn a profit at current costs. So how does that play into the future of AI at this point?
So I think several things about this. One, this whole idea that AIs are not going to become more efficient and that it's just going to be clearly about compute doesn't make any sense. It's not how technology works. It's not how innovation works. Now, what's problematic about it is when governments get involved, this is where you end up with trillions of dollars of malinvestment, and you have things done under the title of national security that have nothing to do with national security, and then it turns out to be really wasteful. But when you start looking at what's going on with some of these models, it's not going to be just this standard, you know, we're going to predict what the next word is going to be. And if we have enough compute power and we, you know, organize and analyze enough information, then at some point this is going to, you know, the human brain uses what, 20 watts. You know, you compare the human brain to a data center. It clearly we haven't figured out how our own brain works, and we're not exactly mimicking that with AI, but there are innovations already happening there. This is where the Chinese have done a great job. There was the release of a model called DeepSeek OCR. And what this does is, instead of, you know, for instance, taking a document, a PDF or something, and then scanning it and converting it to text, you know, one letter or one word at a time, this actually just captures the image, the full image. And there's more information in that image. How the text is positioned next to the images and everything else, that contains meaning. Well, they figured out how to use this other model to reduce the amount of storage by like 80%. So I think that you're going to see major, major, major breakthroughs, and it's not going to be just this, we have to have more compute. But I wouldn't invest in a data center company at all. And I go back to, a lot of people say, you know, I was on a panel with Ed Dowd, and, you know, there are a lot of people that are like, well, you know, AI is a bubble. And there are some people that I think AI is vaporware, which I like to point out there's a difference between the two. I mean, I started my first company during the dot-com era. Was there a lot of waste? Were there a lot of stupid projects? Yes. But did the dot-com era companies completely transform the global economy? And are the companies that came out of that the largest global players today and the most important companies? Yes. So the fact that Wall Street and retail investors were duped, as they always are, and, you know, we can go into, this is SEC laws and everything else that prevent the individual investor from taking, you know, early risk for big rewards. You only get stuck with it after the insiders have made all the money and things are public. It's going public is not making investments more safe. It's cashing out for the people that were in early. But data centers, I wouldn't invest in data centers. I remember at one point in time during the dot-com era, I believe Cisco had the highest market cap of any company, and they reached $500 billion. Right. And they provide routers and hardware and everything else. And it's obviously fallen off considerably from then. So is from an investment thesis perspective, most of the stuff is going to fail. But what you have to understand about the way Silicon Valley works is, because a lot of people will look at this and say, well, Mark Zuckerberg offered a developer $1.5 billion. This is clearly a bubble. Or Google offered a developer $3 billion. This is clearly a bubble. What you have to understand is the way that it works is they understand that they view most of these technology categories as winner take all. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't matter how much you spend. If you don't finish first, you lose. And if you win, then, you know, what, how much are you going to make? $100 trillion? That's kind of what the stakes are. So I was competing against Amazon. When I started my company, I actually formed my first e-commerce company a week before Amazon did. And I was always like, you know, I would always complain and mock Amazon because they went for like a decade without making money. But this was actually the strategy. Their strategy was, no, we're going to do the warehousing. We're going to actually control all of this. And over time, we're going to be the last player standing. And so now they're a, you know, whatever, multi-trillion dollar company. And most, yeah, pets.com is out of business. Siberian Output, any of a number of retailers were out of business. But that's the way that it works. So I don't invest in stocks. I don't invest in any public equities, any of these markets at all. So I don't give advice on this, but do understand that it's, AI is a winner take all. And if you bet on the winner, you're going to do really well. And 99% of the investments are going to go to zero. But that's just part of the creative destruction process for capital anyway. So,
yeah. Aaron, we've talked a lot about all of the problems and issues that need to be warned about and need to be understood at this time. What do you see as the solutions that, you know, that you're using, that people around you are seeing as, let's say, freedom tools and ideas that need to be understood?
Sure. I mean, I have a pinned tweet that's a music video that I put together that kind of summarizes what's going on. But I think that the big risk is technocracy. The big risk is continuing to give over control to for digital IDs, for digital currency, for the tokenization of assets. Centralized AI is a threat. And the truth of the matter is, for most people, you are going to lose your job. I will just using AI on a daily basis, it is actually more efficient than people think. Yeah, somebody will come out and report and say, well, most companies that have invested in AI haven't seen a return yet. But I'm telling you right now, just in the last, I got more done in the last 72 hours than in the last 72 days. And that's actually about the pace that the acceleration is happening. Mm-hmm. And so what I say to people is, you know, one, you have to opt out of these systems. And the way I frame it is this: most people, not everyone, but most people in this country have jobs they don't like for insurance that actually doesn't improve their health, so that they can work this job that they don't like for insurance that doesn't keep them healthy, so that they can have an investment portfolio in stocks that they don't own, because they've given up the voting rights to BlackRock and Vanguard, but those companies that they don't even own the shares in are building a digital prison for them. This is actually the state of quiet desperation that most people are living in. So my view on this is I haven't used a personal bank account since 2019. I've stopped using fiat currency. I'm not saying this is easy. I said this is the way out. Mm-hmm. Don't use insurance. Don't go to doctors. Build alternatives like the medical tourism marketplace. If you can, get your kids out of government schools. But more importantly, what you should invest in is figuring out what your purpose is and what you really want to do with your life, and invest in that. Invest in your own education. Invest in skills. Invest in things that are aligned with your purpose. Because approaching this from a position of fear, a lot of people are not taking action, but they don't even realize that they're protecting something that if they actually examined it, they're pretty miserable with. But what you have right now is not going to be the default. The default is technocracy. Mm-hmm. The default is, you know, we didn't talk about digital IDs, but people will talk about digital IDs. We passed Real ID. Real ID was originally proposed in 2005. It was part of a tsunami aid bill. It was stuffed in there, and it was kind of coming off of 9/11. And it was pushed back, and states fought it. There were like 24 states and attorney generals fighting it and everything else for all of these years. Trump gets elected, and within his first 90 days, Real ID passes. And now it's already digital in 12 states. It will be 20 states, I believe, by the end of the year. And the goal is that by 2027, Real ID will be completely digital in all 50 states. I saw yesterday now that they're going to charge people $45 per flight if you don't have a Real ID. So we already have a digital ID. Over half of Americans already have Real ID. So understand, we have to opt out of these systems. We will not comply our way out of technocracy, But if we instead use a little bit of courage, find our purpose, and build parallel alternative systems, that is the way out, as far as I'm concerned. And I think that it is possible. I mean, a lot of the stuff that my wife and I do at the Daylight Freedom Foundation, we have, you know, 6 different websites, but they're, you know, building alternative healthcare marketplaces, teaching people how to use alternative currency. There's even an incubator for, you know, I want to get into a food freedom marketplace that you use alternative currencies for. There's unlimited opportunity to build parallel systems that are outside of the existing system. Mm-hmm. But we don't have a lot of time. I mean, I think we probably have, you know, a year to get real momentum, or otherwise it's kind of checkmate just based on where we are with digital IDs and the digitalization of all of our assets. Mm-hmm.
Well, Aaron, I really appreciate that message of building skills, finding your purpose. That's very aligned with what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to help teach people. Of course, for anybody that wants more of Aaron's work, that's all available at daylightfreedom.org. And of course, on X at Aaron R. Day. Aaron, is there anything that you'd like to leave our listeners with to think about or to ponder before we do wrap up here?
It really is about free will. And so we have to take control of our own thoughts, our own actions, and our own emotions. Those are things that are under our control. Political systems, all of these other things, we could talk for hours about politics. Although, read my pinned tweet and watch the video, but a lot to say there. Mm-hmm. No one's going to save us. There are no white knights. There is no plan. Trump's not going to save us. RFK is not going to save us. Elon's not going to save us. In fact, the more you dig into this, you find out that these are the people that are actually pushing, at least in the case of Musk and Thiel, mm-hmm. technocracy. So this is all about controlling what you can do yourself, having belief in yourself, and don't give up your agency to people or institutions. And it's actually a hopeful message. We can do this, but man, have we been conditioned. And we talked about, when I said the brainwashing thing early on, you know, social media algorithms. I'm wearing these red glasses right now because it turns out blue light is really toxic for you. So I'm surrounded by screens all the time. Blue light messes with your dopamine system. It messes with your insulin levels. There's a lot of stuff going on here. There are a lot of things competing for and trying to hijack our attention. So the more we can become aware of external things that are trying to take control of our attention and regain control of our own attention, the better off we will all be.
Mm-hmm. Well, Aaron, I want to thank you again for this positive message and a message that a lot of people need to take control of and understand more about. And I thank you again for your time today.
Thank you very much.